This is the fifth day of this April 2010 seven-day session. And we'll resume reading from the teachings of 12th century Chan master Da Hui from the book Swampland Flowers, the letters and lectures of Zen master Da Hui. This is a letter. When people engage in meditation, read the sutras and the stories of the circumstances in which the ancient worthies entered the path, they should just empty their minds. Don't look for the original marvel or seek enlightenment in sounds, names, and verbal meanings. If you take this attitude, you're obstructing your own correct knowledge and perception, and you'll never find an entry. So this is just standard instruction for listening, not just to enlightenment accounts and Taisho, but really to anyone. Just empty your mind. Just listening. And he singles out not to to be thinking about enlightenment or anything else. Then he quotes an earlier master, Panchan. He said, "It's like hurling a sword at the sky. No talk of whether it reaches or not." This is how we want to practice. Pure effort. Just giving it all, our all, without concern about results. It's thoughts of results that impede us. There's a purity to just practicing for its own sake. No thought in the mind about where it might lead. It's really the critical element in working with a koan is flushing out of one's mind any thought of the koan getting us something, and to just question the koan, work with the koan for its own sake, not as a means to an end, for its own sake. The same with the breath. Like hurling a sword at the sky. No talk of whether it reaches or not. Don't be careless, Da Hui says. Vimalakirti said that the truth goes beyond eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. If you want to penetrate this truth, first you must clear out the gates of the six senses, leaving them without the slightest affliction. What does affliction mean? It means to be turned around by form, sound, scent, taste, touch, and phenomena, and not detaching from them. It's seeking knowledge and looking for understanding in the words and phrases of the sutras and the ancient worthies. If you can avoid giving rise to a second thought about the sutras or the stories of the ancient worthies entering the path, and realize directly what they go back to, then there will be nothing in your own realm or in the realms of others that is not according to your own will, nothing of which you are not the master. No doubt he is giving this advice because he's come to see that too many monks are, they have this goal in their mind as they're practicing of wanting to get something, which is natural. Has there ever been anyone who, at least in the earlier stages of their practice, aren't doing it because they want to get something out of it, naturally? But while we're doing the practice, we can't indulge in those thoughts. We can't allow ourselves to traffic in what we hope to gain from the practice. We can. Most people probably do in some almost barely conscious level. It's not that people are sitting just with obsessing about awakening or whatever it is they want from practice, but in little ways, subtle ways, there's usually some kind of referring to it. It's there, sort of in the background, and it compromises the purity of the practice. So when he says, first you must clear out the gates of the six senses, leaving them without the slightest affliction. And then he says affliction means to be turned around by these faculties of the senses. Here Dawi is offering up just the standard Buddhist understanding of this, which is that there are really two things that happen. There is the direct perception, immediate perception of the sound, let's say. There's the sound that you hear, the hearing, but then most people then add to that thoughts about it, associations, memories. They don't simply hear, but there's a residue left. And often a story issues forth from the initial sound, often based on memory. You get words and thoughts in there. This is a process that would never occur to most people, that it's really a more complicated thing than just hearing the geese flying. Most people are not aware of the fact that they then go off on a tangent after hearing, at least just briefly maybe, but still, it's not just the pure experience of hearing. It's not just the This is what the Japanese call nen, one of the most difficult words to translate I've ever heard of. It's what they call the first nen is the direct experience, just that. And then second nen is some trace of thought about it. The third nen is a thought on top of that, and the fourth is still, like now, removed even further from the pure, simple, direct experience of the sound. And then before you know it, you're just chugging off into the horizon on this train of thoughts, and you lose awareness of this present moment. While the train is chugging off like that, you're not present. You're gone. And remember that a thought is, in Buddhism, it's considered basically like the other five senses. Just as we may just hear the sound of a goose, just that. In the same way, a thought arises in the mind, some little random thought. By itself, it's not a problem. It's what we make of it. It's our weaving more thoughts to it that where it becomes a problem. So the Chinese master Lin Qi said, just learn to cut off successive nen, and this is worth more than 10 years of pilgrimage. This is what he means when he says, if you can avoid giving rise to a second thought about the sutras, the stories, and so forth. In the Kanongyo, we say, near the end, we say, this moment arises from mind. This moment itself is mind. What we translate, and for chanting, what we translate as moment is nen. It's thought moment is one translation that you come across for this word nen. And we used to say in the Kanongyo, this thought arises from mind, this thought itself is mind. But that's worse, I think. It's not just a thought. It's this and this. Skipping a few paragraphs here, he again quotes an earlier master, just perceive nothingness in the midst of things. When seeing form and hearing sound, don't be blind and deaf. That's the end of the quote. And then he says, this man knew the truth that the contrivances of the worldly are empty, false, and unreal. When he was faced with situations and circumstances as they suddenly popped up in front of him, he didn't go along with them. So they were taken under control by him. So when seeing form and hearing sound, don't be blind and deaf. That is, don't get attached to sights and sounds. This, of course, is why we adhere to this this very important guideline in Sesshin of not looking around. When we look around, inevitably thought comes into the mind, and then we're taken astray. He goes on, in general, since time without beginning, you have overdone the familiar and left undone the unfamiliar. Even though you may see through it all for a moment, in the end, your power in the path cannot overcome the power of your karma. And what is the power of karma? It is what's familiar and stale. And what is the power of the path? It's what's unfamiliar and fresh. Basically, however, there is no fixed measure to the power of the path and the power of karma. So he's describing this battle that is Zazen when it's conducted most seriously, is the temptation to give way to old habit forces in the mind. It's what we could call the path of least resistance, because it's so worn. Because it's so worn through lifetimes of following, pursuing things, letting the mind go off. It is the path of least resistance. It's like a groove that it's hard not to just fall into it and just move along through it. This is where the effort is called for, to refrain from whatever the habit is. So habits include emotional reactions. Each of us has certain tendencies, dispositions, it's often called in Buddhism, that are part of our character and our personality, ways we react to people and situations. And it's hard not to keep reacting in those ways, because that is how we have been conditioned. The simplest example is getting irritated, getting angry in certain situations with people. Every time we allow ourselves to react with anger, then we're more likely to do it the next time. Goes on, just observe whether or not you are befuddled in the conduct of your daily activities. When you becloud the power of the path, then it is overcome by the power of karma. When the power of karma prevails, then you get stuck wherever you go. When you get stuck wherever you go, then you become attached everywhere. When you get attached everywhere, you consider misery to be happiness. What does that mean? You consider misery to be happiness. When I read this, I thought of the strategy in advertising of trying to develop craving in us for whatever, potato chips, let's say. And you see this in advertising where they use it as a promotion that this, you can't get enough, you know, there. Wow, who wouldn't want that? You can't get enough. And they have all kinds of humorous ways of showing people just slobbering after potato chips or cars or this or that. Wow, who wouldn't want that? To never to be able to get enough. The power of the path. The power of the path is not clinging, not giving way to cravings. It's detachment from cravings. Probably the ultimate craving is to pursue thoughts. Isn't that the big one? It's like the worst kind of addiction. The most stubborn, most powerful addiction. We just can't leave our thoughts alone. Just automatically, reflexively find ourselves pulled away into thoughts. And why? What is that craving, that compulsion to chase our thoughts? Well, I believe that the fundamental attraction of thoughts is that they're something to do with the mind, because the alternative is to have nothing in the mind. The alternative is emptiness, the void. And it is human nature to dread the void more than anything. We'd rather sit and chew over even painful memories, things that people said to us, did to us, old occurrences, old stories that bring us misery, rather than have nothing in the mind. Because when there's nothing in the mind, what is there? Nothing. Human beings are afraid of the dark. Anything's better than being in the dark. The irony is that if we could allow ourselves to let go of all these thoughts and just plunge into that darkness, there is where we find liberation. Freedom, ultimate freedom, true freedom. At first, this darkness can feel ominous, because it's unfamiliar. We're not used to having no thoughts in the mind. So there's something chilling about it. But once we find the courage, and really it is courage, when we find the courage to keep returning to this realm of mu, or no thought, whatever you may call it, whatever the version is of no thought, then we come to experience how sublime it is. Skipping a few paragraphs, he says, if you are a true person of wisdom, you will use the power of the path as an instrument to clear away the power of habitual action. Once the power of actions, which is karma, once the power of karma has been cleared away, the path too is empty and false. Even the path. The path is just an expedient means. We call it the path, but it's just refraining from dwelling in thoughts. The path, maybe the original, in the original Chinese, it was the Tao, the way. You will use the power of the way as an instrument to clear away the power of karma. The way, for each one of us, the way is our particular practice. Here's a letter where he's replying to someone who must have written to him about empty illusion. And so now Dawi says, speaking of empty illusion, it is illusion when created and illusion when experienced too. It's illusion when you're knowing and aware and illusion when you're lost in delusion too. Past, present, and future are all illusions. When we first realize our ignorance, we take an illusory medicine to cure an equally illusory disease. When the disease is cured, the medicine is removed, and we are the same person as before. If you think that there is someone else or some special doctrine, then this is the view of a misguided outsider. Here he's reminding his student that ultimately all of this is, it's all words to just to enable us to see through words. We talk about the Dharma, the way, the path. It's just a way for us to be able to apply ourselves to this matter of emptying the mind, of even the most exalted terms. We get this also in the Prajnaparamita, this denial of anything having any substance. Or is there pain or cause of pain or cease in pain or noble path to lead to pain, through pain? Nor is there wisdom to attain. Attainment too is emptiness. We mentioned this a few days back in Taisho. Harada Sogaku Roshi, in his epitaph, his dying words, he wrote, "For 40 years I've been selling water by the river. My efforts have been wholly without merit." Ha! Here's a letter to a secretary, Luo. He says, "Since we parted, I don't know whether or not you can avoid being carried away by external objects in your daily activities as you respond to circumstances. whether or not you can put aside your heap of legal documents as you look through them, whether or not you can act freely when you meet with people, whether or not you engage in vain thinking when you're where it's peaceful and quiet, whether or not you are thoroughly investigating this matter without any distracted thoughts. Of course, he's saying, are you? Are you? Are you? Are you? It's the Chinese style. I don't know. How could I know that? Whether you are being carried away by external objects. We all know what that means, being carried away by external objects in our daily activities, how we can completely forget the practice, or even that we have a practice for big stretches of time. It's very humbling. Say you're working on a koan. 10 o'clock in the morning, you realize that koan hasn't even entered your mind for 3 hours. Notice this phrase, whether or not you can put aside your heap of legal documents as you look through them. Reading them without reading them. Whether or not you can act freely when you meet with people. We all know this. All of the forms of self-consciousness, preoccupations with self and other, when we interact with other people, thousands of little variations of thoughts. Whether or not you engage in vain thinking when you're where it's peaceful and quiet. So now here he's asking about when we're alone, let's say. When we're alone, how many people can just be just aware without thinking about oneself, without falling into the I, the me, and the my. It's rare. It's rare. Because of this unremitting voice in the mind that just goes on and on and on wherever we are. A master once said, why are people so unhappy? Because 99% what they think about is themselves, and there is none. I believe that most people don't know anything but that internal dialogue. If you were to say, what would you say when you're alone, say taking a walk, just home, alone. Do you think about yourself much? I bet most people they wouldn't even know how to answer. They didn't ever occur to them because the thoughts have become just such background noise. He goes on, the Buddha said, when the mind does not vainly grasp at past things, does not long for things in the future, and does not dwell on anything in the present, then you realize fully that the three times are all empty and still. You shouldn't think about past events, whether good or bad. If you think, that obstructs the path. You shouldn't consider future events. to consider them is crazy confusion. Present events are right in front of you. Whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, don't fix your mind on them. If you do fix your mind on them, it will disturb your heart. Just take everything in its time, responding according to circumstances, and you will naturally accord with this principle, with the way. Don't fix your mind on things of the present. That is, don't create successive nen, but do become one with things in the present. Becoming one with, let's say, eating, as we're eating, to just be completely one without thoughts in the mind. This is refraining from fixing the mind on them. When we do this, just becoming one with, then we move along with change, with time. We're not stuck in time. Unpleasant situations are easy to handle. Pleasant situations are hard to handle. Then he goes on to elaborate. For that which goes against one's will, it boils down to one word, patience. Settle down and reflect a moment, and in a little while, it's gone. It's pleasant situations that truly give you no way to escape. Like pairing magnet and iron, unconsciously this and that come together in one place. Even inanimate objects are thus. How much the more so for those acting in ignorance, with their whole beings making a living within it. In this world, if you have no wisdom, you will be dragged, unknowing and unawares, by that ignorance into a net. Once inside the net, won't it be difficult to look for a way out? This is why an early sage said, having entered the world, leave the world completely. To anyone here, this is self-evident. Having entered the world, leave the world completely. That's what Sesshin is, really. It's really quite a remarkable thing that pretty much for the first time in history, it's primarily lay people with very busy lives who attend Sesshin, who leave the world for a week. In former times, throughout the history of Buddhism, you pretty much had to become a monk, a monastic, a monk or a nun, in order to leave the world. But here we have this opportunity, from time to time, to just seclude ourselves in this this realm of simplicity, where we're not, we don't have the demands of all of the complications of our life, all the responsibilities. We can just leave it all behind and apply ourselves wholeheartedly to this practice. But really, he's not talking so much about a meditation retreat, I think, as he is cultivating a way of being unattached even in the midst of daily life, worldly life. The only way we can do that is through daily sitting. If you think that if you're not sitting and you think you're detached from your life, you're just deceiving yourself. The only way we stand a chance is through daily sitting. Then we have a chance in the potentially binding circumstances of our daily lives to just exhale, drop it, drop the shoulders, exhale, and move on without getting snarled up in what people are saying or doing, or snarled up in thoughts of the future or thoughts of the past. Another master put it this way: to be in the world, but not of the world. And this is a very, very advanced state of spiritual practice, and it's never an all or nothing thing. We just, over the years, we get better at not getting caught in things. And then he ends this letter: "What I've been talking about thus far is all my personal life experience. Even right now, I practice just like this. I hope that you will take advantage of your physical strength and health and also enter this stable equilibrium." This is why people become teachers, because they have benefited so enormously from this practice that they can't help but want to share it with others and see others develop the same freedom. Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.